This is episode number 49 with Ben Cardarelli, CEO of CrossFund. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Sendek, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur. And in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise more capital, build better companies, and to give you a better understanding of the people behind the biggest funds in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, beautiful people, welcome to a new episode. Today, I'm excited because we're dialing into China. We're going to talk everything about angel investments and how that works, you know, how to become like an active angel investor with Ben Cardarelli. A few highlights from your journey so far. Initially, it kind of started also traditional, at least with some gigs with management consulting firms and banking. But you are the founder of Ballpark. You're the founder of Nexus Education. You're an angel and mentor to many startups. I think I counted like 20 plus startups. And currently you also run and you're the founder of CrossFund. What is CrossFund? An invitation only, a professional venture collective that empowers founders to raise early stage capital and connect with accredited investors and mentors experienced in building cross-border early stage tech companies in emerging markets. So a mouthful, but I think the whole idea of CrossFund is really like for angels by angels type of platform, right? Which is an amazing initiative. Ben, welcome to the show, man. How's life in China?
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it. I'm really excited to be here. Yeah, all is well here. Hoping that COVID gets better and better. We're in our third year of COVID, but everything is fine. So excited to be talking to you today.
That's cool, man. And big shout out to Alan from Boson Ventures who connected us. So if you're listening, Alan, big shout out to you, man.
Yeah. Great friend of mine.
Awesome, man. So let's talk about CrossFund. I mean, like I mentioned before, you've done angel investing many times before you launched CrossFund. So maybe you can tell us a bit more like how you rolled into angel investing. And then eventually how that angel investment activity rolled into, you know, building CrossFund to where it is today.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it was my background as a founder that really got me into angel investing, mainly because I wanted to share my experiences, my knowledge and my learnings from being a founder with other founders. So that was actually my main motivation and impetus behind investing. I wasn't so much actually thinking about the financial gains from it, just to be honest, because there are many other ways to make money, I always say. I think if you want to invest as an angel in startups, it really has to be because you're passionate about it. You want to help young people grow, want to help economies develop. So for me, it was more just a way to give back and share my learnings with other founders. So that's kind of what piqued my interest in it. That's how I got started. I was really investing in companies and business models that I felt comfortable with, like fintech, education, even energy. I just understood these sectors a bit better. So that was kind of where I started. And then over time, it kind of grew and expanded as I started to learn more, because when you invest, you also learn a lot from people that are hopefully smarter than me. So I was learning a lot, and then my interests expanded.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Because if you talk about fintech, for example, or education, I know that now at the moment, now you are running an education startup as well, right? But if we go back early days, let's say angel tickets, right? What was the first exposure or the first actual angel ticket that you did? And what were you doing at the time?
Yeah, great question. Actually, my first angel ticket was into an esports company. It was called Prediction. Actually, it was an esports podcast network.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was because my sports tech venture in the past, a Ballpark, we had some exposure. Obviously, we knew a lot of pro athletes. We knew a lot of sports organizations. We knew a lot of media companies too. So I just felt that I had a network, especially in emerging markets, that could help the founder, help the company. So yeah, my first investment was in Prediction, and it's been an exciting journey with them.
That's awesome. And so that investment was in line with the business that you were running at the moment, at that specific moment.
Yeah, it wasn't fully in line, to be honest. It wasn't fully in line, but there were definitely some synergies between what I was doing at the time and that business. So I felt I could support them with the network and the business I'd built.
Yeah, and what type of ticket was it? Like, to make it a bit more specific, like how much were you investing back then?
Yeah, it was a $30,000 investment. It was $30K. Yeah, so I think, you know, there are all kinds of angels. Some angel tickets range from as small as $5,000-$10K up to 100K, 250K, million dollars or more. So for me, I like to try and keep it somewhere less than 100K for startup, because my philosophy as an investor is that, one, beyond the money, I want to try and bring value too.
Yeah.
So I hope I can actually bring value beyond just the capital. Yeah. And two, I think it's important to build a diverse portfolio. So not just putting all your money into one startup, but really trying to diversify and build a portfolio that has more balance. Yeah, that's my philosophy.
I totally agree with that philosophy, right? But when you look at angel investments, there's always interesting sectors where, you know, macroeconomically speaking, you're like super yielding towards a market, right? Whether that's crypto or whether that's sports or podcasting or fintech or whatever it is. But the value add is not always very evident, right? Because for example, with Ballpark, for example, maybe there were some aspects of the business where you could add value, right? But it was in that sense a different business than what Ballpark was in, right?
Correct. You're right. I think it's true. I think one philosophy I also try and follow is really to only invest in things I know. So I'm not going to go invest in industries that I don't feel comfortable in just because I want to get exposure. For instance, like, for example, I'm not still so well versed on things happening in the crypto space or metaverse space or NFTs even. So I don't have too much allocation there because I don't fully understand everything in that space, just to be honest.
Yeah.
But things like fintech, edtech, B2B models, insurtech, I understand these areas more. So I tend to, I guess, have more allocation in these kinds of startups.
Do you think that investing as an angel, because I think the value add is crucial, right? Especially for angel investments, which implies that the startup itself is very early stage, so it needs a value add. But as an angel investor, as an angel investor, you don't know. I mean, you cannot always add a lot of significant value to any type of segment, right? But do you feel that as an angel investor, you are, quote unquote, limited to the field that you are active in or have been active in? Or do you think it's still very reasonable or maybe even dependent on the risk appetite of the angel investor to invest in sectors where he or she has never been part of?
Yeah, that's actually a good point, Andrew. I think if I can say two things there, I think the first thing is, I think fortunately platforms like Crossfund, for example, and even just angel syndicates to a certain extent can kind of help investors get allocation in deals that maybe they wouldn't normally be able to invest in because they're not so experienced in that space or in that industry. But if they can kind of pool their funds together through some kind of vehicle, some kind of group or a platform, they can get some exposure. So I think for sure that's one of the benefits maybe of things like Crossfund and also angel syndicates to a certain extent. To other point, I think you're totally right. I think it just depends on the risk profile of the investor. Some investors say, oh, you know what? I don't really know what's happening with crypto, but it's taking off. I want to try and get some allocation. I'm going to put a ticket into a crypto startup just to say I have one and give it a chance. Yeah. So, you know what? I don't want to do it. I know nothing about it. I haven't spoken to the founder for 5 months. But anyways, I think it really is based on the investor profile.
That's so true, right? Because early stage requires a lot of, well, especially as an angel, right? If you're an angel in an early stage startup, you want your money to count, right? You want your money to count from a total pool perspective, but I think also from a voice perspective, right? Because you invest, and like you said as well, you want to add value. Like, how do you add value now? Like, if you approach, I mean, there's of course, let's say investing through Crossfund, which is in that sense a bit more quote unquote anonymous. But let's say in your tickets before, like, how does it operationally look like in your case now if you add value?
Yeah, it depends. I think I always say I don't want to push the founders. So I really want to try and only help as much or as little as they really need me to. I don't try and force myself. I would say I'm more passive, to be honest. But it can look like things like having a weekly or monthly call with the founder to help them think about their strategy, help improve the pitch deck, help improve the business plan, discuss the marketing approach, whatever it is. Sometimes it can be through introductions. For example, a lot of the times I make introductions to other angels I know in the space, to VCs for future funding rounds. It can be through some kind of commercial partnerships. Sometimes I've tried to help companies build partnerships with others. For instance, just just thinking about a prediction, because I mentioned it, when they were trying to grow their podcast network in Southeast Asia, I tried to make different connections to esports talent agencies in places like Philippines, even Indonesia, actually, even in China, to see if there are ways they can work with talent locally. So yeah, these are some ways that I try and bring value as an angel. Some founders, it's more, you know, hands-on, every week we're doing things. Some is more monthly, some is just quarterly. But I always try and be there as a sounding board if you ever have any doubts or want some support. I would say the earlier stage startups too are normally the ones where I'm more engaged. Yeah. The ones that are getting later stage, then the VCs come in. I still really believe VCs are owning the funnel at the later stages of investing, like Series B, C, D. So once it gets to that point, that's then I would say I'm less engaged for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Would that also mean that you're out? Like, for instance, okay, if you angel invest early stage,
yeah.
What is your thought about like exit opportunities for angels?
Yeah. Well, I always say I only invest in things that I believe in long term. I don't try and play it like the stock market where it's like, okay, I'm gonna stay here for a year and then exit. I always say I only invest if it's a long term game. However, there are more and more opportunities, even on CrossFund, we're trying to build that as well, like a secondary market where angels can actually exit at certain points, like maybe during the Series A or B or C. I always say in those opportunities, if I'm satisfied with the return and if I feel like the amount of growth is going to come is not going to be so much and maybe it's going to have a lot of risk with it, then maybe it's just better to exit at that point, right? It's better to have an exit of whatever it is, 20x, 30x, than try and hang in there and then lose it all.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, just talking about the multipliers, right? Talking about the 20x returns.
Yes.
Oftentimes when you look at VCs or how VCs started, it starts with angel tickets, right? It starts with angel investments where they build track record. And based on the track record, they will be able to kind of like raise an institutional fund, right? Raise a big fund.
Yeah.
Has that been, I mean, I know you do CrossFund now, right? Which is more on a platform type of base. Mm-hmm. Have you thought as well about actually launching an institutional fund as well? Has it been something on your mind or not at
good
all?
Good question. Yeah. I definitely agree. I think the best way to start getting into the, let's say, VC space is to be an angel. When you're investing your own money into things, you start doing your own diligence, your own analysis, your own engagement with the founders, then you kind of build up expertise, hopefully a successful track record to go with it. I would say for me, actually, to be honest, I was never so motivated to be like a VC. Maybe I would think about doing a family office one day if I get to that level. But VC, no, I think it's because I really see myself as a founder first still. And with CrossFund, you know, we're also a startup, we're a fintech, we're growing.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm more like founder first than VC focused. I feel like a lot of VC sometimes, they don't really know the founder game. Not all of them, of course, but I feel like some don't really understand what it is to be a founder. It's not their background. They've just been kind of in investment banking or capital markets or things like this. So for me, I always see myself as like a founder first. So that's why I thought to do CrossFund, to give more people or angels access to deals.
Yeah.
Also give founders smart money. But I never actually thought about being a VC. But you're right. I think most angels and people who start syndicates, their plan is to try and raise a VC later on.
You mentioned something interesting, right? Which I think is crucial as well. I mean, I talk a lot about this with early investors, which is more on the diligence part, right? The DD in especially early stage startups is sometimes challenging because a lot of the information or all of the data room, so to say, is based on assumptions. It's based on assumptions, right? There's usually one shape which comes back, which is the shape of the hockey curve, is usually the one that comes back oftentimes. But the reality is oftentimes a bit different, right? So if you look at your own DD process, let's say over the years, you kind of like develop maybe some key metrics or key points that you're looking at to decide if you want to go through with a deal, yes or no. What would that process look like on a high level?
Yeah, it's a good point. Okay, I think a lot of times if the company is very early stage, let's say we're talking like pre-seed round, right? Now these seed rounds have gotten actually bigger and even later stage. If we're talking like pre-seed or angel round, I really think honestly that what's inside the data room doesn't even matter, to be honest, because it can be all fake. I mean, who really knows? And of course, it's going to change, right? So for me, the biggest thing is the founder actually, and the founding team. Do mm-hmm. I feel comfortable with them? Is there some kind of relationship that we've built or we can build it? Do I actually trust the person? What's their experience, their background? Have they shown some kind of traction in the early days? This actually to me is the biggest thing. If it's really early stage, like angel, pre-seed, of course I always go inside the data room, but what I see, I always take it with a grain of salt. I mean, yeah. It could all be wrong, could all be false. How can I really verify this? I'm more making a bet on the founder, just to be honest, right? Yeah. I'm not going to try and tell you that's a special way.
No, of course. And that totally makes sense. It totally makes sense. So I think when you look at, let's say, early stage startups, especially pre-seed, mm-hmm. like pre-revenue even companies, there's the founder element and then there's the business model element, right? I think founder element, I think totally makes sense. You need to have that trust. You need to really believe the track record and the capability of these founders to drive this business to the next level. When we look at the business side, in every standard pitch deck, you have your key elements, right? From the team, from the TAM, and then the business opportunity, blah, blah, blah. What are some key metrics? I mean, apart from the soft side and apart from the characteristic of the founder and his track record or her track record, what is important to you? I mean, you know, in this angel phase that you do, it's not all pre-revenue, right? There are some that are already Correct. Have some traction. Correct. But yeah. what are some key metrics that you look at before deciding yes or no?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was going to say, when it comes to the companies that are doing like a seed or series A or mm-hmm. somewhere in between, then it's more about the metrics. I'd say some key metrics, one is just revenue. Like, what's the revenue growth? Especially monthly revenue and monthly GMV, how fast is the company growing? Sometimes we look for the number of customers too. Depends on the model, but like, is it B2C or B2B? Sometimes if it's B2C, it's more about users. If it's B2B, it's like the size of the customer. Maybe it's only one or two customers, but they're big ones. We also look for any kind of like recurring revenues. So like, there's guarantee this money is going to be coming in future months. This is always a big one. Yeah. The burn rate's also important, because normally I don't want to invest if it's like, company's going to run out of funds in 3 or 4 months or something. It has to be some kind of cushion, you know? So the burn rate's also a really big one. The size of the team is important too. Like, how big is the team? We don't want it to be too small, but also if it's too big, maybe there's just too much burn.
Yeah.
So here are some basic ones that we can, that we look at. Also, if it's like a platform, more B2C, sometimes we look at the number of active customers or active users.
Yeah.
So people actually using this platform on a daily basis or daily month. The customer cost of acquisition is also something we look at. Like, can this company actually get customers and be profitable, or just too costly to invest in getting customers? These are some key metrics that we look at.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm not a formulaic person. I think the startup space tends to be it's different in a case-by-case scenario. But these are kind of the general ones we look at. I wouldn't say, oh, the cost of acquisition has to be like this, you know, this number, or else I'm not going to invest. I don't look at it like that, but I do look at it case by case, and it's important to be aware of this so you know what you're investing in.
Yeah. So true. Totally agree. And when you look at your current portfolio, right? Current portfolio of all the angel investments that you've done, how would you categorize them? Let's say in different buckets, or have you categorized them in different buckets? Are there some specific verticals that you really believe in?
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, last night, I finally went back into my portfolio and started categorizing some companies, because I said I have so many investments and losing track of like which sector they're in, the amounts I've been putting in, the stage. Literally, I was trying to track it in my own Excel here. But I would say definitely fintech, I really like a lot. I think one, because my experience is in it from back at Accenture, but two, it's also just because I think it's really hot space. And most of the big valuations and big multiples are coming out of the fintech space right now. And I think there's a ton of potential in fintech and emerging markets in particular, because I'm more emerging market focused.
Yep.
So yeah, fintech, I have it. Geographically, I would say like, I think I have 8 or 9 investments in Pakistan. I was looking at last night. I knew I had a lot, but I think I have like 8 or 9 there. Yeah, so I'm very heavy in Pakistan. I have a few in Vietnam too. So yeah, I would say those might actually be my most popular markets.
Oh, that's cool, man. Vietnam and Pakistan are kind of like your big, so fintech. So we're leaning towards fintech, Vietnam and Pakistan.
Fintech,
those are kind of like your categories.
Oh yeah. And Africa.
Okay.
I don't want to say Africa just broadly, but yeah, places like Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, these tend to be places where I have exposure.
That's awesome, yeah. Man. And so let's talk about deal flow, right? I think it's always interesting
to see.
Like, because it's a very, it's not very, I mean, obvious, you know, you say like, oh, this guy, Ben in China is now investing in Nigeria or other African countries or Pakistan. So how did it kind of come about that you had this deal flow coming from all these different countries?
Yeah, that's a great question. Okay, I think the first thing, if you're getting started as an angel, is really about building up your deal flow and your credibility, i.e. why would somebody really want you on the cap table beyond your cash, right? Yeah, so for me, when I was starting 4 years ago, it was really about how do I actually build up a really big network. So I was doing a lot of networking, even just online, because then COVID happened. So a lot of it online, on LinkedIn, trying to talk to accelerators, other angels, VCs in these places, in these different countries, right? In Nigeria, in Ghana, in Kenya, in Pakistan. So once you have that kind of network, then they start feeding you deal flow. Then you can start getting, you know, 50, 100 deals a month. You can look at them. You can start to actually pick and choose. I always say a good angel really only invests in 1% of things or less that they see. I mean, if you're investing in everything, you're probably doing something wrong. So it's more about building up the deal flow first and seeing what's out there. People trust you. Then once you have that, you can start to build up your credibility in terms of why a company should actually take you on their cap table or take your money. Pakistan in particular, for me, actually, this might be interesting. For me, I really believe it's just in like macro trends, macroeconomic trends. So Pakistan really took off last year. I was looking at Pakistan 2 or 3 years ago, so I was a little bit early there. Main reason why was just macroeconomically, I thought it made sense. Even though I've never been to Pakistan, I've been to India. I actually lived there for 2 years. Pakistan, no. I just thought that the percentage of young people, the total size of the population, right? It's the eighth most populous country. People are very tech savvy. A lot of people study abroad, which means they have really good education, then come back to Pakistan.
Yeah.
A lot were doing that. I just felt that it made sense that at some point, this country should start to develop really good founders and really good startups. I wasn't sure when, right? It might be 2 years, might be 5 years, 10 years. Never really know when. We can't predict the future. But I believe that if you invest in, right, a certain macroeconomic trends, it should come to fruition.
Yeah. You're still with me?
Yeah, I'm still here.
We're good, right? Shall I turn off?
We're good.
Shall I turn off the video or no?
Yeah, sure. We can do that.
I mean, just
do that.
Just to keep it a bit lighter, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that's gonna help.
Yeah. Okay, there we go.
Okay, so the deals in Pakistan and Vietnam is or even in Africa. I mean, so a lot of it has been done also like outbound, right? So from yourself, you reach out to accelerator programs locally so that they source you with deals. That's kind of like the start of expanding that angel investment footprint, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think you have to start that way because, you know, unless you become Mark Cuban or something, right? Well, people really reach out to you and say, hey, I have a deal for you.
So
I mean,
true.
It won't happen until you have a certain level of credibility, right? So
that's interesting, man. So let's just make it a bit more practical, right? So let's say you reach out to an accelerator program in Pakistan, right? You've never been there. You've lived in India for a couple of years, but you've never been to Pakistan. So you look at it from a more macroeconomic perspective. You look at the profile of Pakistan and you say like, okay, I believe like tech is going to explode here and there's going to be a lot of value creation, right? And then you reach out to different accelerator programs. They start feeding you with, hey, Ben, we got this interesting fintech company, which is now trying to raise $200,000. You want in, yes or no? So how was that process of, you know, writing your first check there in Pakistan, in a country that you've never been? And you know, arranging the safe note, like arranging the papers, the legal stuff around your angel ticket. Like, was it scary? Like, how did that go?
It's a great question. The first thing I did was I kind of set a certain pool aside, right? Like a pool of money, let's say.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, this is the amount I want to try investing, and this is the specific amount I want to go towards Pakistan, other emerging or frontier markets, right? Yeah. And then I just start saying, okay, I only have, let's say, I don't know, $100,000 or $80,000, whatever it is, to invest in Pakistan and also Bangladesh, for instance. So how many deals can I really do? Maybe I can do 4 or 5 deals, maybe only 3, depends on ticket sizes, yeah. Who knows, right?
Yeah.
And that's it. Then I started looking and trying to fill in the boxes. I'm kind of like trying to fill up my own little portfolio, of course, and seeing if I can get the deals I want. Then I always ask to talk to the founders, right? So I talk to, for example, in Pakistan, there's a VC called I2I Ventures. Mm. There's also one called Caravan. I know them well, so they can feed me deals. And even if I like the deal, I always ask to talk to the founders. That's like mandatory for me.
Yeah.
In almost every single case, I got to talk to the founders and meet them. And that's kind of the first step. I still do my DD. I go inside the data room. So I'm kind of like trusting my partner on the ground, so to speak, the VCs, but then I'm still doing my own diligence too. And then there are some that I really like, but anyways, I don't have the allocation. Right, I've only allocated 80K, let's say, to Pakistan.
Exactly.
So I can't do more. So it's just too bad. And then the founders get pissed and they yell and say, "Hey, you think we're not good? No, I think you're great.
Yeah.
It's just I really don't have I don't want to invest more than what I committed already."
And so that foot on ground. I mean, that local partner, whether that is an accelerator program, whether that is a VC that you have a good relationship with, that one is of course crucial, because that is sort of your first line of defense, right? Because your diligence in that sense only goes so far, right? Because you're like thousands of kilometers away from where this startup is actually based.
Yes, yeah, definitely you have to trust people on the ground. I would say, you know, if there's a company in any country really that's talking to you that hasn't been able to raise funds from someone locally, even just angels, then I'd see it as a bit of a red flag. Like maybe what they're doing is not solving a real problem. Yeah. Unless you yourself have been on the ground and you know it, maybe you're seeing what other people aren't. But if you haven't been there, so you don't really know, and no one else is investing locally, that tends to be a bit of a red flag.
Yeah.
I'm not somebody who, just to be clear too, I'm not somebody who believes that like, the best startups and best founders are in Y Combinator or Techstars or whatever, to be honest. I really think good founders can come from anywhere. But if there's really no one locally that's interested, that would raise some concerns, as maybe, or the founder really isn't using he's not talking at all or trying to build a network, which is also a concern. It means maybe he's not talking to enough people.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there has to be some kind of local interest.
Yeah. Yeah. To kind of like justify or validate, or just validate that initial.
Yeah.
Hey Ben, if we look practically, right? So let's say you have now, I don't know, 25 or 30 investments or even more. And it's funny that you say that. I was even thinking about that. Okay, man, if you have so many investments, that Excel sheet can be quite confusing maybe, right? So how do you do that now? Like, how do you manage these, how do you manage your own portfolio? Are you using Excel or are you using some type of SaaS software, which kind of like makes it easier to overview?
Yeah, it's actually a great question. So because I have over 30 investments now, I have 34 according to the spreadsheet last night. I realized what was happening was I was thinking, oh my God, I have so many, and I'm forgetting like some are convertible notes too. So like, they're going to mature at some point. I was curious when these things are going to happen and what the cap is for all these companies.
Yeah.
That's why I went through and I just used Excel at first. So now I have an Excel. But yeah, I'm looking at different softwares I can use. I've been sent a few from some of my VC like friends and partners that I can look at.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna try and use those. But yeah, Excel is trustworthy. I trust all the numbers there.
That's a good thing. That's a good one. You thought it were 30, but actually you have 34 investments.
That is
so good, man. That is so good. And since you're based in China, do you also, because I have interviewed a few investors from China as well, and we often talk about parallels between China and then Southeast Asia, right? Where they say like, okay, there's a certain trend happening in China. Most probably it will happen in Indonesia, for example, as well. Do you look at things also from that, let's say, broader China perspective, or is it really deal by deal basis how you look at your potential investments?
That's a good question. China is a very complicated place. I've never invested in mainland China.
Okay.
I think to a certain extent, I actually consider China as almost a developed country. I know a lot of parts aren't. I mean, I live in Chengdu, which is, I wouldn't consider it a developed quote unquote city in China. It's not like Shanghai or Beijing or Shenzhen and stuff. But I feel like China's kind of developed in a sense. So for me, the opportunities really lie in like other emerging markets, wider Southeast Asia, Africa, Middle East. I do think there are a lot of learnings in terms of business models that have worked in China that can be replicated in other places.
Yeah.
China, right, it's such a populated country. So things like like Pinduoduo, for example, or WeChat, just to use some examples, or Alipay, for instance. Models like this that really work because of the scale, I think that can work in other places that have really big populations, like Indonesia, for example, or Pakistan, or India. India is also a complicated market, by the way. But places like Indonesia, Pakistan, I think the models can transcend to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like I remember that even when we were building our e-commerce, we were looking at China a lot, especially how they executed social commerce. And then we're talking about like 6-7 years ago, and now you see kind of like the adaption of social commerce, quote unquote, as a concept being much more accepted. So you just see sometimes it's also a bit too early, right? To just quote unquote copy paste things from China and then launch it here, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think if somebody's to your point, I think if someone's just trying to copy paste without trying to think about the local market or change things here or there, there's high chance of failure, to be honest, because each market has its own kind of secret sauce.
Yeah,
so maybe at a high level, the model can be copied, but how it's actually done in practice, the nooks and crannies, I guess, so to speak, or nuts and bolts, I think that has to be localized.
Yeah, so true. Hey, looking at your angel investments, looking at, you know, your own fintech with Course Fund right now, how do you kind of see this like moving forward, like let's say 5 years from now? Because like you said, you see yourself more as a founder first and then like angel investing on the side. But how do you see it like 5 years from now? You see CrossFund really evolving into like an angelist / Republic type of platform, or you know, coming back to my previous question, like, or do you really see that this angel investing becomes a more quote unquote institutionalized activity from yourself?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Well, I think CrossFund has a ton of growth and potential. I really think our team is strong. I'm really happy with everyone on the team and our progress so far. I think ideally we can grow to become a platform similar to an AngelList Republic hybrid for emerging markets. And hopefully that can add value to the ecosystem, to not just founders, but also add value to syndicates and VCs and accelerators. Yeah, and then maybe, you know, hopefully there's enough value. Of course, we'd love to have some kind of exit, right? It'd be great to either do some IPO or acquisition. So that's my plan for CrossFund. I really believe we have a chance there. Personally, I would love to have, not be a VC, but maybe have a family office one day.
Yeah.
I would love to do that. And again, be more founder first and still more founderish, let's say.
With it's more founderish.
Versus, versus being a VC.
Yeah.
But let's see.
Yeah, there's a very good distinction between the two, by the way. So that's all. Even though, you know, I mean, a lot of the VCs I talk to, and we have this discussion also about, let's say, the parallels between founder life, entrepreneur life, and launching your own VC. I mean, there's still a lot of parallels, right? Yeah, a lot of parallels, right? Looking at Southeast Asia, right? I mean, your portfolio, you know, crosses or covers, you know, from Vietnam, Pakistan, Africa, and I think a lot of countries in between as well. And a lot has been said about Southeast Asia and the different categories within. And I know you lean a lot towards fintech, right? If you look at your portfolio right now, but if we look at the bigger tech ecosystem, are there any categories where you're super bullish about, like just personally you're super enthusiastic about, that these categories will really explode in the coming years ahead?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are two categories I think in particular that I tend to be bullish on right now. Anything that deals with like small store owners or like small retail stores in emerging markets, I'm pretty keen on, like serving them inventory. Because, you know, in Africa, a lot of consumers in many of the countries in Africa actually buy at like local, like retail stores. They don't go to like big supermarkets. It's all done in like local retail stores. Same thing even in India, for example, in my experience there. So I think ways to better serve those stores, to get inventory, to sell to the end users. I think there's interesting things happening in that space. And there's not much tech yet inside these like small retail stores. So I think that's a big thing. Second thing I think is like being able to provide financing to unbanked people or even unbanked little small stores, let's say, like businesses like that, I think is also an emerging trend. So like this, like it's B2B, but it's almost B2C because like it's such a small store. It's like a one person shop kind of thing, or two person shop. I think that's a big opportunity right now. I'm also really keen on like buy now, pay later. I don't want to sound too
too hip,
trendy, but
yeah
too trendy, but I definitely was in on buy now, pay later, when it was just becoming a thing. I think I have 4 or 5 BNPL investments now. Oh, I really awesome. Believe it's solving an issue for consumers in emerging markets. So
yeah,
these three, I would say I'm really focused on. There are also things happening in metaverse. Like I really believe the metaverse is here to stay and it is the future. Oh, sorry. My son is wants to share his thoughts too. I think there's things happening in crypto also. Yeah. But to be honest, my experience is not there, so I'm still trying to educate myself.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
learn more about what the real opportunities are there.
Yeah, beautiful, man. So you already have now a few buy now pay later startups that you've invested in so far.
Yeah. Actually, my first investments, but my first buy now pay later investment is actually a company called Kispay in Pakistan, which I think I'm up like 10x or something on it, maybe 12x.
Wow.
And the founder is really strong. Yeah. And they're doing great.
That's awesome.
So
man.
That was
That's
my
awesome.
First exposure to BNPL.
That's awesome, man. So like a thing about value creation, right? I love this discussion about, let's say 10x up, right? At the moment now, the 10x up is still paper value, right? And
great point.
So I want to talk more about paper value versus cash at hand. Like, do you also have trading stocks? I had a funny conversation even today with a crypto trader, and he was like, okay, you know what, with investing you need to be very disciplined, meaning okay, once my price drops 5%, I always go out. You know, once my price hits my target price, but then drops again 5%, I'm out. So setting up these rules to actually turn the paper gain into actual cash at hand. What is kind of like your philosophy around you know, turning that on paper valuation, on paper multiplier into exiting on time?
Yeah, that's actually a really great question. And I hope I get more and more exits, so I have more experience turning the paper value into cash.
Yeah.
But I think the key thing is looking and understanding how much growth is really left in a company, right? For instance, sometimes when a company is doing a Series B, right, the chance will really go into Series C, D, E and do an IPO. It's not always likely, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then the chance that the growth they get in the later stages, it really like is worth it, right? It's going to go from 30x to what, 35, 40. Is it really a huge difference?
Yeah.
At that point, you can just take your exit and reinvest those earnings into 5 or 10 more companies.
Exactly.
Right? Or more. Yeah. So, I hope to get more experience about how to turn that into paper into cash.
Yeah.
But I think it definitely has to be considered.
Yeah. But do you apply like certain principles for you, or is it more dependent on the round, or is it in the safe note that you're signing can get out anytime? Like what's kind of like, what are the downsides, right, of angel investing? Like, is there sometimes a lockup period, or is it very?
It's actually a great question. One thing that's the biggest downside, I would say, or the biggest risk to angel investing, and this is why I started CrossFund too, is because most angels will be investing in syndicates, right?
Yeah.
Like on platforms like AngelList. And when you go into those syndicates, or any syndicate really, you really have no control over the exit. So unless the person leading the syndicate decides, hey, I want to exit, let's all exit this investment.
Yeah.
Or for some reason, the company wants you to exit. I don't know. Some VC tries to push out the syndicate. I'm not sure. I'm just thinking about a worst case scenario.
Yeah.
You really have no control over the exit. You're kind of just stuck inside the SPV waiting for an IPO, an acquisition. Yeah.
Exactly.
Or the syndicate lead to say, hey, guys, let's exit. I think it's great. So that's kind of uncomfortable, right? And I'm in several of those. And again, it's because I have conviction that this thing will work long term. Like I'm forecasting acquisition or IPO. I'm not actually expecting to have any kind of chance to exit before then.
Yeah.
But that's definitely a risk because you're just stuck there. That's why we're trying to create a secondary exchange on CrossFund where angels, even inside the SPV, can choose to get out and cash out and liquidate
at any time
they want.
At any time.
Yeah. Correct. Well, there are some restrictions. I mean, you can't just do any time. You don't want to down round the company. Certain times, like when a round is open, right before it opens, you can try and exit.
Yeah.
I think that would really help angels a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think the topic which also comes by very often is liquidation, right? I mean, you invest up until IPO or up until M&A, but then you're kind of dependent on either the performance of the company or dependent of, like you said, the syndicate leader, you know? So it's more like the control as an angel, you don't really have control. You're kind of like dependent on what's happening. So now with CrossFund, actually you are providing more exit opportunities or a more flexible exit opportunities for your investor, which is really amazing, Ben.
Yes. Oh, and actually, by the way, one thing someone told me, which I hadn't thought about, I wish I had, but I hadn't, to be honest, is that it also benefits the founders, because in reality, there's a different type of investor is helpful at different stages.
Yeah,
I think it's true. The investor who's going to be supportive in the, let's say, angel stage, pre-seed stage, is not the same angel that's going to be helpful in the series B, C, D stage.
Yeah, so true.
So for a founder, for you to be able to say, okay, thank you, angel, for helping me. Here's your 50, 100X for being part of this journey. Now I'm bringing in some big VCs. Mm. We're going to support my later stage. I think it actually benefits the founders too.
So true. Yeah. So true. Even on a leadership level, there's CEOs who can drive a business up until $50 million a year, and then there's CEOs who can drive it to $1 billion a year, right? I think that is also not always the same person. So I think that definitely makes sense, man. Hey, Ben, two final questions, right?
Sure.
As you've been angel investing for a couple of years, right? And some did well, maybe some didn't. If you now look back, and you would have to classify or identify key characteristics of a good angel investor, what would that be?
Great question. Well, I think to be a good angel, the first thing is you should know what you're looking for. So you shouldn't be trying to talk to every single company, every single space or market. You should really try and like narrow your focus.
Yeah.
Two is you should know what is your value. How can you try and help startups? It doesn't have to be something amazing, right? You don't have to be, again, Mark Cuban or whatever it is, but you should know what kind of value you can provide. Then I think you should be really founder first. So you shouldn't be like an activist stage. Yeah. You should be more supportive. Four, you should ask questions though. You shouldn't be somebody who just sits back and says, yeah, do whatever you want. You should ask the right questions and see how you can support and try and channel it in your own way for the founders. I think you should also have a certain level of risk tolerance. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of startups will fail, right? Less than 5%, even 2% will work out in the long term.
Yeah.
So you have to have a certain risk tolerance, understand that. I would say these are some of the key traits.
Yeah.
And also having a network, I think, is important as well as an angel.
Yeah. It's funny. I think one of the first points you mentioned is more like, what is it that you want, right? Like narrowing down your focus, I think is a really, really good one, which gives you more indicators for, you know, what is important and what is not. Because I think when you just jump into the angel investment space, it's like, oh, I see a lot of opportunities everywhere. I want to join this round. I want to join this round. But it's really about what is it that you want. So that's a really good point. Ben, we come to the last question of the interview, right?
Sure.
I want you to imagine a day far, far away into the future. And on this day, there is a search engine where I'm going to type in the name Ben Cardarelli, right? And this search engine is giving me a result which only consists of 3 bullet points, because all the rest besides the 3 bullet points, your digital footprint is gone. There's nothing on LinkedIn, nothing on Facebook or Instagram, your social media, nothing about CrossFund, nothing about your quote unquote accolades that you have achieved in your life. But the only thing it shows are 3 bullet points. And these 3 bullet points that represent the life lessons of Ben Cardarelli. What would those 3 life lessons be? And this could be life lessons about life, or it could be about
life lessons. Wow.
It could just be anything which you want to be remembered by. What would that be?
That's a really hard question. Well, one philosophy I've always had, which is, it says, always remember that neither success nor failure is ever final. Mm. So I hope that would be a lesson, because I really think that, you know, you have success doesn't necessarily mean it's going to carry over again to the next startup, for example, or the next thing you do. If you fail, there's always opportunities to get better. So I think this is something that's important to be remembered by or to live by. Mm. Something that sounds better, but something around like impossible is nothing. It sounds cliche. I hope is a better way to spin it than on my Wikipedia, but something around that, because I think a lot of people really don't pursue what they want. Even like startup founders, they don't take the risk and do it because they're so worried about failure or so worried that they can't do it or so many obstacles. I really push people to take the risk, because there's so much potential if it works and so much learning, even if it doesn't.
Yeah.
So I think these 2 things are really important. The third one, that's a tough one. I always say that I want to be remembered as somebody who, whatever I did, I really committed to it. And I'm the same way about my investments, right? If I decide to invest in somebody, whether it's 10K or 100K, I'm really committed to it. I'm not going to try and exit the next day or be looking for the back door when things go wrong. I always want to be remembered as somebody the founders can say like, hey, he really supported me. Maybe in the long run, he wasn't the biggest investor, but he was the most helpful one. He was always engaged. He responded to my monthly updates with some ideas to improve on. He tried to make VC introductions for me, whatever it is. I want to be remembered as somebody who is really committed to helping, in this case, founders or people just get better.
Yep.
Because that to me is really important.
Love that, man. Love that. Where are we without commitment, right? And I think that's a very good reminder to anyone listening now. I mean, if we want to achieve something in life, we gotta put in the commitment, man, and else it's gonna be very difficult. Hey, Ben, amazing journey, man, and thank you so much for sharing your journey so far. Where can people find more information about you or about CrushFund, or if they want to shoot you a pitch deck, like where would they contact you?
Yeah, for sure. I would say the best thing is on my LinkedIn. Okay. Maybe in 50 years it won't be there, but
now, yeah, who knows?
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, you can find me there. CrushFund's an invite-only platform, so definitely connect there first if you want to go into CrushFund, and then we can chat more about giving you access to the platform.
Yeah.
Any founders, they can also find me on LinkedIn. They can also fill in a form, so startup.crushfund.asia.
Okay.
They can go to that form and submit their company, and we're happy to take a look at it.
I'll put everything in the show notes so people at least know where to find more about CrushFund and know more about Ben Cardarelli. Ben, really appreciate it, man. Enjoyed our conversation. It was amazing to see like how you really involved your angel investing activities and now built fintech with CrushFund. Super excited to see how that will evolve, and how it will become like the main platform for people to really get exposed to angel investing. So congrats on all the achievements so far, and looking forward to connect in future times as well. All right, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll be in touch.
Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then please make sure to subscribe over on Apple or Spotify. And I'd really appreciate it if you can leave a rating and review and let me know what your biggest takeaway is this episode. Thanks again, and I hope to see you in the next one.